Hello, everyone. Welcome to Masterclass tonight, July 13th, 2023. We welcome everybody that will be here tonight. We have a great agenda coming up. For the agenda tonight, we have Sam Schneider with The Power of Efficiency, Zach Remsted with MQTT protocol, and then I will be showing Rashmi Raghukumar with credit card and credit card statistics in the U.S. Let me go ahead and admit this person. Okay, I'm sorry if I totally ruined your names on that. I'm doing my best. Sorry. And people have trouble with mine. So, okay. Sam, you will start us off. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready to go.
Okay, go right ahead.
Okay, so I share my screen.
Yep, and make sure that you click at the top, include computer sound if you're going to be using that.
Give me 1 second. Do I do screen or window?
Screen.
Okay. So I'm gonna make this full screen.
It will show. Yeah, there you go.
It's showing?
Yes, I see it. If you go to the very bottom and you click the little book.
The reading view?
That one, yes. There you go.
Okay. Well, my presentation will be on efficiency. I titled it The Power of Efficiency. What is efficiency? Efficiency is the quality of achieving the largest amount of useful work by using as little energy, fuel, effort, etc. as possible. Efficiency, it plays a large role in my life. I'm a person who tries to stuff as much into his time as possible. So I'm very typically doing 2 or 3 things at the same time so I can achieve that. So that's why I got this idea for this presentation after talking it over with Charlene. So efficiency isn't just important in normal life. It's also important in technology. And one could say that technology itself is efficiency made manifest. From something as simple as lighting a fire to cooking a meal to get more nutritional value out of it, or the creation of a wheel in order to transport objects more effectively, to more recent examples such as factories that allow for goods to be produced by the thousand in less time than it would take to put together by hand by the... Yeah, I'm sorry. My grammar was worse there than I expected. To putting together a... Another example would be the Microsoft Teams, which we are now using to efficiently hold a long-distance conference with multiple people scattered around the world. Just 15 or so years ago, this wouldn't have been as easily possible, but now we can do so with just a few clicks of the mouse. Why is efficiency important? In today's fast-paced world, efficiency is crucial for organizations to stay competitive and meet the ever-increasing demands of customers. It enables businesses to streamline processes, reduce waste, and make the most effective use of resources, ultimately leading to improved productivity, cost savings, and customer satisfaction. Efficiency is also important to daily life, as there is only so much time in the day and so many days each week. By planning your day in an efficient manner, you're able to complete more tasks than you would have been otherwise able to do so. The key principles of efficiency are streamlining processes, eliminating waste, and maximizing resources. Streamlining processes refers to the act of optimizing workflows to eliminate steps, reduce complexity, and improve overall efficiency. It involves identifying and eliminating bottlenecks, automating repetitive tasks, and reorganizing workflows to ensure a smooth and streamlined flow of activities, resulting in increased productivity and reduced costs. In other words, by using a method by which it is completed more effectively, you can reduce the amount of time spent on that activity. One simple example of this has been used for many years that are the stamps that contain return addresses on them. By making use of those stamps, you can skip the process of writing out the address and replace it with merely stamping the envelope. In the amount of time that it would have taken out to write the address, you could have completed over a dozen envelopes in a similar amount of time. And thus, it's a very efficient manner of doing so. Nowadays, we use computers for a lot of that work, but if you're writing by hand, it's still very useful to go about it that way, and you can skip the printing process. The second of the key principles of efficiency is eliminating waste. Eliminating waste involves identifying and eliminating any activities, resources, or processes that do not add value to the product or service. This can include reducing unnecessary steps, minimizing idle time, eliminating defects or errors, and optimizing the use of resources such as time, materials, and energy. By eliminating waste, organizations can improve productivity, reduce costs, and enhance overall efficiency. The essential thing when it comes to eliminating waste is to understand what processes and resources have value and cannot be replaced. Once you do that, you can then understand what is not necessary and can cull it or replace it within a more idealized version. I believe in the idea that new processes are always important to continue to be tested, but you shouldn't completely overlook the old process. Sometimes they're better not only from a quality standpoint, but also from a productivity standpoint. And because of that, it's important to try each new process and compare it to the old. Although, unfortunately, that costs a lot of money and in some cases. So it's not always ideal. The last of the key principles is maximizing resources. Maximizing resources involves making the most effective and efficient use of available resources to achieve the desired outcomes. This includes optimizing the allocation of human capital, financial resources, technology, equipment, and materials. By maximizing resources, organizations can increase productivity, minimize waste, and achieve optimal results with the available resources, ultimately improving efficiency and performance. For a more fun example of maximizing resources, there's no need to look any further than an RPG. In a game with limited resources, it is much more efficient to focus your resources on those that matter most to your character. If you're playing Pokemon and you're trying to build a competitive team, and you're planning to use a Tyranitar, as you can see over here, then you aren't going to be focusing your resources on its special attack, which isn't very effective. You're going to be focusing on its attack and its other stats so that it can be used better. And it's the same way with real life processes. It's best to put your eggs in the baskets that are going to wind up mattering the most. Efficiency in your daily life. Efficiency isn't merely useful in business practice. It also has its role in daily life. Some of the most common efficiency tools used regularly are calendars, planners, schedules, and shopping lists. Many of these, as everyone's noticed, are baked into a lot of other applications that we use commonly, including Microsoft Teams, which 15 minutes before this very presentation happened, I got an alert saying this class would be coming. And then I got another alert saying that it was time to join. And by doing that, I can efficiently join at the right moment rather than there being some sort of delay or me not noticing as long as I'm on my computer. Efficiency-driven technology. Efficiency has its place in business as well as several technologies. Efficiency has its place in business as well. And several technologies have been created to make work more effective, such as remote work tools, virtual assistants, and chat boxes, and online project management platforms such as Monday.com, ClickUp, and Rike. In the case of virtual assistants and chat boxes, they might not be very efficient to customers, but a lot of the times they sort of allow customer service platforms to also weed out the amount of time that they only have so much time that they can allocate to each customer. So they hide themselves beyond menus before that could potentially help you. And then they can more efficiently use their time. So if you go to a website with a problem and you start chatting, you'll probably get a bot, but then the bot might fetch a human who can help you with your problem as necessary. And meanwhile, that person could be helping another person or two in the meanwhile, which makes it efficient, but mostly on the side of the company in question. So over the years, there's been a lot of challenges in implementing technology for efficiency. While efficiency has only ever been a good thing regarding producing increasingly effective results, progress is often resisted by people for both good and bad purposes. For instance, many products that used to be done by hand can now be completed via automation of some level or another. Using books as an example, they used to only be available for the rich due to the time and effort it took for a trained scribe to copy out the book in question, and then for the craftsman to create the book cover and bind the pages. This usually took more than one craftsman doing more than one type of thing, such as leather work and paperwork, and it was more expensive and more difficult to make paper back then, and everything else involved. With the creation of the letterpress, however, it became possible to create many more books much more cheaply, and in doing so, those that used to work as scribes lost work. It's very understandable to resist change when it results in the loss of your livelihood. However, many more people can enjoy those books that wouldn't be able to before. And those results are why efficiency needs to continue to improve. I mean, you can see in the modern day that there's so many more books than there used to be. There, the spread of the literature in the world and the entire industry has not only spread the number of books that people can write, but it also leads to increased education, which leads to more jobs. So in many ways, while those people unfortunately lost their jobs in the past, the efficiency of getting that information out to more people eventually led to more education and greater development for humankind. The second part of this is, while it is understandable for a person to resist change when it affects them negatively, there are others in history who have resisted change because they consider the improvements to not be traditionalist or the way we always did things. And there are sometimes merits to this line of thinking, like I said before. However, I believe that is incumbent of someone to learn new ways when they are indeed better. However, not all methods are necessarily better, and they should be tested against what came before to see if they are more efficient. Some things are faster if you just write them out rather than taking out your laptop and writing them down, or your phone, or anything. It's important to always consider what tool is best for what task, and that's another part of efficiency. It just newer isn't always better, but as time goes on, there's more options, and it's more likely that one of those newer options is going to be more efficient one way or the other. So in addition to regular tools, like I mentioned before, there's also efficiency and productivity software that specializes in exactly that, making your life more efficient, making your work more efficient. And these come in the form of software and applications that specialize in it. For instance, look for no further than Microsoft 365, which we are currently using ourselves. It allows us to make use of various applications in one convenient location and complete tasks such as creating documents or this very presentation, which I am given right now. There is also efficiency software such as Rescue Time, which gives you a daily focus work goal to meet based on analysis of your past activities. This is really useful because you can really focus rather than saying, oh, I'll get to it eventually later in the day. It can give you maybe 3 hours to do something, and instead of stretching it out for an entire 8-hour period, you could get it done in those first 3 hours because in the past you've done similar amounts of work in that period. Another example of this is Freedom, which, much like parental controls, acts as a block on websites and applications that may distract you, such as social media, streaming sites, and shopping sites, and others like it. While I'm not a fan of these types of blocks in general, I like the idea of one that you turn on yourself so that you can focus on your work. And that makes it so it's another step to disable it, but it doesn't prevent you from potentially accessing a necessary website if you need it. And then you're able to just focus on your work better. Another example of this is Trello, which can be used to keep all the information your team needs to be organized in one place. You can assign members certain tasks, add due dates, leave comments, and so on. In some ways, Trello resembles some of the Microsoft applications we're using, such as Planner and some of the other tools like Teams. But it's a different sort of application. It doesn't cost as much, and it's very work-focused, while Microsoft Word can, and the other applications are a little bit broader in application. So in conclusion, while efficiency might sound like a method of doing more work in less time, applying efficient practices broadly to your lifestyle will allow you to do more with everything, whether it is in your free time, where you might be gaming, or when you visit an amusement park. Choosing the most efficient path will let you spend more time gaming by minimalizing the amount of time spent doing other things, and allow you to make use of the available information to maximize the number of rides you go on in an amusement park. They have all these apps nowadays where you can log on to Disney's app or Universal's app or wherever you're going, and they'll give you an estimate of the wait time. And by using that and keeping an eye on where you are in the park, you can go on many more rides than you could if you're just wandering around randomly and getting into long lines. And I think that's the appeal of efficiency. You can maximize your workflow, but you can also maximize the amount of time you spend having fun. And that's why efficiency appeals so much to me. And that's the whole level presentation.
Excellent. Very good to put that out there. So that helps a lot of people right now, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've been applying this to the internship, my time at Purdue in general. It's been enormous. And it's also made me evolve as just someone who's getting the workout. Because in the past, I was always really bad at getting work in on time. I was always starting things last moment. But now I have a better idea of who I am, how long I take to do what I need to do, when I can do what I'm doing, and what I can do at the same time as it. And because of that, I'm able to, I've just done really well at Purdue, and I'm happy to be concluding on a high note.
Yeah, I get that completely, because I would always wait until the last day to do my work, you know? And it's terrible because you have a whole week and then you wait until that last day.
It definitely can be. And sometimes I do that to myself on purpose. So at Purdue, sometimes I feel like working right away. And it's important to, with how much work we get each week, it's important to know when you're going to be doing that work. Yeah. So when you feel like doing the work, you should do it.
Yep. Exactly.
You should do it when you're motivated. On the other hand, like I said, I've also left stuff for the last minute on purpose because I know I'll feel backed into a corner to do it. And then I'll have the motivation one way or another. So that is another way of doing it. But you shouldn't do that with everything. And you should know yourself and whether you're able to do that. And you shouldn't just leave everything for the last minute.
That's a great point, is to know yourself. You know, if you're a procrastinator, that you're going to do it every time. So try not to, like, purposely get yourself to do it ahead of time, and don't feel forced. It's just something that you have to do because it's something you're paying for when it's schoolwork and things like that, or work itself. You know, it's, you signed up for it. You got to do it.
Exactly. A lot of work is down to obligations rather than school or at a job. So you need to fulfill those obligations, but you should definitely know yourself and how you can best accomplish those tasks. And I think efficiency and applying it correctly is very useful, both from a technological standpoint and also from a daily standpoint.
Right, Exactly. Well, that was a great presentation. Thank you so much.
Does I'm glad anybody you else have it.
A question for Sam?
All right, then. Everyone, thanks for listening. I appreciate the comments, too.
Great.
Good luck to everyone else.
Thank you. All right, Zach, your turn. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Just let me bring my screen up.
Okay.
All right. Can you guys see the PowerPoint?
I do, yes.
All right. So for today, I'll be starting by taking a brief look at the history of MQTT. We'll dive into how the broker works. I'll cover event-driven versus polling for data collection. I'll take a look at some of the industry applications that MQTT supports, and then I'll cover some brief information on how you could get started using MQTT at home if you would be so inclined to. So MQTT stands for Message Queuing Telemetry Transport. It was developed in 1999 by Andrew Stanford Clark and Arlen Nipper. It was standardized by OASIS in 2013. They still maintain that standard today. And it was originally developed for monitoring and sensing equipment that required or had to be used in a low bandwidth environment. We're currently on MQTT 5.0 as of March 7th, 2019. 3.1.1 is still widely supported. I had to look up why they skipped 4 in actually one of the bytes within the variable header of the control packet. The revision number is referenced as 4. So to respect that, they've just moved on to 5. To cover how it works, MQTT is a TCP protocol. It consists of clients and a broker system, and it operates on a publish and subscribe system. So in the diagram on the right, you can see the MQTT broker represented in the center with the clients on the left and right. On the left, we have temperature sensors, which would be the clients, just as well as possible users or applications represented on the right. The sensors would publish a value. In this case, it's 20 degrees C. That gets sent to the broker, and then the client at the top has subscribed to the broker to get updates on that value. So once the broker receives that update, it will then publish out that information back to the client that subscribed for it. And this supports machine-to-machine communication as well as IoT environments. And again, because it was designed for low bandwidth, it's great in applications where network strength isn't ideal. And next, we'll cover the quality of service of MQTT messaging. This is a way to ensure that messages are received at the broker from clients. The first is quality of service 0, which is at most once. It's kind of a fire and forget method where it just sends it. There's no confirmation needed. The next one is quality of service 1. This is at least once. This ensures that the message has been received at least once. It's kind of like saying hi to a friend. You know, you might have to flag them down, say hi a couple times to get their attention, but that's all right. It'll continue firing messages off until it ensures that one of them has been received. And then quality of service 2 is exactly once. This you can think about like sending money to someone. If I Venmo someone $20, I want to make sure they get it, but I don't want to keep sending that money to make sure that they got it. So this requires a little more communication and a back and forth between the clients and the broker. To briefly cover event-driven versus polling data collection, polling requests information from the machines. This is done usually at a millisecond or second frequency. It's very fast. And when you look at manufacturing applications where many of the lines are controlled by PLCs, this can be very taxing on the computer resources of the PLCs. They're very robust, but comparatively less smart than a PC that we're using right now. They're fairly lightweight on computer resources. And older factories, these are likely already pretty taxed. So you want to help preserve that by driving on event. And the on event means that it only updates on change or under certain conditions. If I'm watching a sensor to see if a light goes green or red, I don't need to keep asking it, are you green? Are you green? Are you green? I only want the update to be sent to me once some sort of sensor has read that it's turned green. And that again helps preserve bandwidth by reducing the back and forth traffic over the network. One of the first industry applications we'll cover is the UNS. The UNS is the Unified Namespace. MQTT is a protocol that can be used to support these architectures, and it is compliant with the ISA 95 system integration. To take a look at the right, this is kind of a traditional manufacturing business software stack. So at the bottom of the pyramid, we've got our sensors and signals. These are collecting all the data that we'll use. Going up a level, that's the controls layer. This is usually where it's interpreted and then used at the floor level. Next is the SCADA, or supervisory control and data acquisition layer. This is where you usually visualize that data to understand the current state of a manufacturing line or plant as a whole. Next, you've got your manufacturing planning system and your enterprise resource planning systems. These don't need as much of that data from the sensors and signals, but they'll use some of the KPIs calculated in the mid-levels to kind of display how the business or plant is doing as a whole. And these brokers, where you'd have your data organized, can be bridged. This can be throughout a factory, across the country, or across the world. They really help connect that data. And to kind of break down what a UNS is to a more personal level, it's almost like having folder paths where you would have those levels through a factory. So for example, in the diagram on the right, if I had a UNS of my house, I could have it broken down where the first layer would be my house, and then I would go to the kitchen, and then I would read from my temperature humidity if I wanted to see how hot it was in the kitchen. If I wanted to add another sensor or another room or location even, I can simply publish another value to the broker, and it'll update those folder paths to accommodate new information and new routes. And a neat tool of MQTT is the wildcards. One of them is the pound sign, which returns all tags below the last layer published. So if I subscribed to the my house / pound sign line, that would return everything under it. So in this case, it'd be everything within the kitchen and living room. This is kind of useful for troubleshooting, or if you just want to get at a glimpse everything that's being published at a certain level. Another one is general IoT support. This is great for connecting devices and sensors, or an alternative is making data more accessible. Again, kind of relating to factories with those PLCs or older systems. I know one of the plants that I've been in, they had systems still running on MS-DOS using floppy disks. They're older systems, but with the support of devices, IoT devices such as Raspberry Pi or a board with an ESP8266, you can place these devices at the edge connected to that hardware to gather that data from the PLCs and controllers and then publish that to the broker to where people within the factory or even remotely can gain access to that data and connect it to applications or other needs. And MQTT does accept XML and JSON formatted data, as well as just raw values, strings, integers, doubles, whatever it may be. And the final industry application we'll look at tonight is the digital twin. This is fairly self-explanatory. The goal is to digitally represent your factory. This can be through collected data, or commonly it can also be done as a 3D representation of what's moving around in the plant currently. One of the ways to do this is to use one of the MQTT client libraries or an API to bring the data into a simulation software. And then through using scripting, you can connect that data to modeled assets that will move around as the data is updated. And this shows a real-time state, position, and flow of items in the plant. To kind of connect this to some work that I was involved in and what I'm currently learning now on the internship, we had done this similarly. On a kind of demo or proof of concept line, we had AGVs or automatic guided vehicles moving around the line. And as they would move, they would publish their X and Y position as well as their rotation to our MQTT broker through some C# scripting done by a vendor. That was then actually brought into Unity, where using that game engine, the AGVs and kind of the floor layout were modeled and updated live. So you could pull that up next to the line or at home to see how the AGVs were moving around. And seeing that done in Unity and working in Unity now, it's really connecting the dots. I'm getting some more ideas. So that's been really interesting to see happen and to learn about. And to wrap it up, if you'd like to get started at home, I'd recommend using the Mosquito Broker. It's free and very easy to configure. After installing it, it takes about 2 lines of altering a config file to have an open and running broker. But just as well, it supports MQTT over TLS and WebSockets, and you can apply certificates to make things more secure. If you'd like to take a more enterprise approach, there are ways to create certificates for users, and it does support LDAP integration if you had an AD system you'd like to connect to. And it's compatible with most Linux distributions. I've worked with RHEL, Ubuntu, and Raspbian for the Mosquito Broker. And, you know, Raspbian, that last one, set it up on a Raspberry Pi or Ubuntu. If you wanted to install it on a, you know, VM on your desktop, both of those would work. And I've had little issues. It really doesn't require a lot of computer resources to get started. And then to support that, there's the PAHO client library. You can get this for Java, Python, JavaScript, C, C++, and C#, as well as some other languages. It covers really all the popular ones. And then there's the Eclipse Foundation, which supports PAHO, has a wealth of documentation. And just as well with the quick Google search, there's plenty of forums, guides, videos, and step-by-step procedures to get you up and running. And then the MQTT Explorer is a great tool for troubleshooting. This kind of runs as a wild card to, once you connect to a broker, it'll just show you absolutely everything that's publishing through that. Which is great for me to see when I need to gauge how many tags are live or if I've made a spelling mistake and I'm not putting my data where I think I am. And that kind of concludes the overview of MQTT. I'd like to thank everyone for your time today and then open it up for questions.
Excellent job. I had no idea. Brand new.
Yeah, I only learned about it 2 years ago, but I've been really enjoying it ever since.
That is really cool. Anyone have any questions for Zach? Okay, I guess you made it very clear. You made everything, all the information very clear. Basically, a coded sensor that can report live data.
Yeah, well, the protocol to support that in the software.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Great job. Okay. I will do Rashmi's. Let me get that screen. And she has a recording. Can everybody? Can you see the screen?
Yep, I can see it.
Oh, but you can't hear it.
No, there's no sound.
Of course. Because, you know, I forgot to do what I tell everybody else to do. Let me put it over there this time. And that, and that. Okay, can you see the screen?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yep.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Rashmi. I will present you all about credit cards and credit card statistics in the US. Credit cards are not a modern financial innovation. The concept of credit card dates back to ancient times. Much like modern-day credit cards, ancient civilizations like Mesopotamian and Arapan used clay tablets to track trade and transactions. Ancient credit card. The figure is a clay tablet used by Mesopotamian and Arapan civilizations. The earthen tablet bore seals from the two civilizations and was used out of necessity. The volume of goods traded between them was so large that paying with physical money would have been too cumbersome. Modern credit card. A modern credit card is a plastic or a metal card or a combination of metal and plastic that allows you to access a line of credit offered by the bank that issued the card. Every time you pay for something with a credit card, you borrow money from the card issuer to cover the purchase. You must repay the money in full at the end of the month or over time. Credit card has 13 to 19 digits that can be used for transactions. Each symbol and number on the card serves a purpose, whether for fraud protection or simplifying transactions. The card holder name is the name of the account holder. Valid through is the card expiration month and year. Hologram is a small shiny 3D sticker placed on either front or back of the credit card. Hologram also ensures the card is legal and not easy to copy. CVV is the card verification value, a fraud and security measures for credit and debit card. EMV chip, Europay, MasterCard and Visa chip is a small magnetic chip for fraud protection. How do credit cards work? When approved for a credit card, the bank authorizes a credit limit, the maximum amount you can borrow, to be used at your discretion. Your credit limit will depend on factors such as your income, other debts, and how much available credit you have on other cards. When you receive the bills, you pay a certain minimum amount, the entire balance, or some amount. Paying just the minimum every month is ultimately the most expensive option since it will cost you the most in interest. Paying in full is the best option when you pay in full each month. You get a grace period to avoid paying any interest on purchases. Major credit card networks in US. When you think of widespread credit card networks, Visa and MasterCard probably come to the mind first. In terms of purchasing volume, Visa is the clear leader with more than $2 trillion in 2021. MasterCard is the second closest competitor with over $1 trillion. American Express and Discover round out the networks at $892 billion and $182 billion respectively. Credit card networks by percent of purchase volume. This pie chart depicts the credit card network by purchase volume. Visa is the clear front runner in terms of purchase volume in 2021. The same can be said over the past 5 years, with Visa always maintaining at least 50% of the market share among the four major networks. Visa was steadily increasing its market share over the years, growing from 50.57% in 2017 to 53.99% in 2020, but in 2021 dropped to 52.6%, just slightly slower than the 2020 percentage. MasterCard has been consistent at around 22% of the market share across the past 5 years, while American Express has declined slightly from 22.85% in 2017 to 19.6% in 2021. Discover, while the smallest in terms of the major networks, has held steadily at around 4% of the market share over the past 5 years. Number of credit cards in circulation in the United States. This pie chart depicts the 2021 credit cards in circulation in the United States. Visa comes in at the top at close to 50% of all credits in the circulation in 2021. This lead has slowly declined over the past 5 years, falling from a high of 52.84% in 2016. People are gradually moving towards MasterCard as its share has steadily increased, while American Express and Discover remain fairly consistent by percentage over this period. Major credit card issuers by percent of outstanding balances. This pie chart depicts the top credit card issuers in 2021 by average outstanding balance. Credit card issuers such as banks, retailers, or credit unions issue credit cards to consumers. There are many credit card issuers, but still I have limited the data to the top 15. Here, I have included both general purpose and store card issuers. For example, issuers such as Synchrony Financial, City Retail Services, and Alliance Data Systems all issue store cards for business such as Old Navy, Sam's Club, and more. Outstanding balance shows how much of your available credit limits and the credit issuer sets credit limits. This data factors in people who pay off their balance on their cards each month and those who carry a balance. Chase was the largest issuer of outstanding balance in 2021 at $154.30 billion. Citibank, Capital One, Bank of America, and US Bank round out the top five. There are over 15 card issuers, but combining the outstanding balances from the remaining issuers adds up to lessen any top five issuers. Major issuers by purchase volume. This line graph depicts the top credit card issuers in the US by purchase volume. Here we can see a drop in purchasing volume in 2020, while an increase in purchase volume in 2021. American Express and Chase has the most significant jump in numbers from 2020 to 2021. Chase and American Express were 2021's top issuers in market share by purchase volume with a volume of about $850 billion to $950 billion. In fact, these two issuers were also the top two over the past 5 years. American Express was previously the leader in this category, but this flipped for the first time in 2020 due to the large than average decline in purchasing volume. Citibank, Bank of America, and Capital One made up the second tier of issuers, hovering in the $400 billion range. The remaining three banks in the last tier include US Bank, Discover, and Wells Fargo in the $130 billion to $180 billion range. Credit card market share facts. Based on the four payment card networks, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover, by the end of 2020, there were 485 million open general purpose cards and 214 million open private label accounts. In 2021, Visa had nearly 50% of all credit cards in circulation in the US. When combined, Visa and MasterCard dominated the market in 2021 with over 75% of spending by purchase volume. 2021 saw an increase in purchase volume compared to 2020 across all networks, and Visa saw the most significant increase with an overall $400 billion increase. The top 10 card issuers in the United States held nearly 88% of outstanding credit card balance in 2021. Chase had the largest credit card market share of any issuer in 2021, measured by outstanding balance and purchase volume. How do credit cards differ from other cards? A debit card is linked to your checking account. Debit card purchases automatically pull money out of your account. You are using your money to pay for things rather than borrow it. A prepaid debit card isn't linked to a checking account. Instead, you load money onto the card and can only spend as much as you have loaded. Neither debit nor prepaid cards will affect your credit scores because using them does not involve borrowing money. Only a credit card will affect your credit score. Types of credit cards. Rewards credit cards give you something back for each purchase you make. Generally, these cards require good credit. They come in different types. Cashback cards give you money back. Airline credit cards and hotel credit cards give you miles or points that you can redeem for free flights or stays with the card's partner airline or hotel chain. General travel cards give you points that you can use to pay for any travel expense. Store credit cards reward you for loyalty by giving you discounts or other benefits for shopping at the store that provided the card. Low interest cards don't give you rewards. Instead, they provide value with a lower interest rate, making it less expensive to carry a balance. Balance transfer credit card lets you move your debt from another issuer to take advantage of a lower interest rate. Credit card options for those with less than good credit are more limited. Rewards are more scarce and interest rates are higher. Student credit cards, being a college student, doesn't automatically qualify someone for a student credit card. The Credit Card Act of 2009 prohibits issuers from giving cards to people under 21 unless they have a proof of income or a co-signer, someone willing to put their credit on the line to help the applicant build theirs. Reasons to get a credit card. Debit cards are appealing because they don't involve borrowing money and won't rack up debt, but they also don't help you establish credit history. Building credit is one of the key benefits of using a credit card. Others include sign-up bonus. The bonus could help you start an emergency fund in the case of a cashback card or take a trip. Ongoing rewards. Rewards give you back some of the money you spend. Building credit. Establishing a good payment history can help you borrow money in the future at lower rates. A 0% introductory APR period. This lets you avoid interest on purchases or balances transfers during a promotional period. Flexibility. Though it's best to always pay your balance in full each month, a credit card allows you to pay for things over time, which helps when you have a major purchase or financial emergency. Costs of carrying a credit card. Credit cards can come with costs, but you can avoid most of them with responsible use. They include interest payments. Credit cards can have different interest rates or APRs for purchase, cash advance, and balance transfers. When you pay in full every month you purchase, don't accrue interest. Annual fees. Some cards charge annual fees from around $20 to hundreds of dollars. Annual fee can be worth paying if the card gives you rewards and perks that make up for the cost, but in most cases, you shouldn't pay a fee just for the privilege of having the card in your wallet. Late payment fees. The cost varies by issuer, but federal regulations limit how much late fees can be. As of 2018, first-time late fees were capped at $27, and the fees for a second late payment within 6 months were limited to $38. Late fees also can't cost more than the minimum payment due. Balance transfer fees. Generally, balance transfer credit cards charge 3% to 5% of the amount of debt transferred. Some cards waive the fee when you transfer debt within a certain time frame. Foreign transaction fee. Most cards add a surcharge of 1% to 3% on transactions made with non-US merchants. Travel credit cards generally don't charge these fees, and some issuers don't charge them on any of their cards. Tips for effective credit card use. The benefits of using a credit card responsibly outweigh the costs. Here are some best practices to adapt. Pay your bill on time and in full every month. Keep your balance below 30% of your available credit. Wait at least 6 months between credit card applications. Review your account online weekly to track spending and avoid fraud. Keep no annual fee credit cards open and active to avoid hurting your credit scores. Using a credit card responsibly is an easy and efficient way to establish healthy credit. You will be thankful that you did so when you are able to borrow affordably in the future. References. These are the supporting resources used to prepare these slides. Thank you, everyone, and Marjorie Fure for giving this opportunity.
Well, that was excellent. That was very cool. A lot of information to get from that. And if you didn't know about credit, now you know, right? That was great to see the numbers. And a lot has changed over the couple years. You know, you see them go up and down like that, too. I would say any questions, but Rashmi's not here. I'm sure you can chat with her later if you had any questions on that she might have found. Other than that, I want to thank everybody for what they had to say tonight. Great presentations. Again, I love Masterclass. Awesome. But everybody, thanks for coming. Have a great night. You know, if you miss the masterclasses, we have them not only in Teams, but they are on PGI Pods also. I've been putting them on there. So if you want to see some of the older ones, you can always go on the website, pgipods.com, and see them on there. But again, we do have them in here on the masterclass playlist. So everybody have a great night and a good weekend if I don't see you tomorrow. Thanks,
good
everybody.
Night. Thank you to the presenters. You guys did well. Always great learn job. Something new.
That's right.
Thanks, everyone.
And thank you.
All right. Take care.